Welcome to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and this week I'm wondering about the state of America, namely the intersection between law, politics, and the media. I have two guests to help us unpack the alliances and tensions between those three areas of American life. First, Katie Couric, who has been in the media business for 40-some years now in a variety of roles, who has a really honed perspective on where we are, how we got here, and where we might try to get to next. After Katie, we'll talk to Neil Katyal, a Georgetown law professor who has argued in front of the Supreme Court 47 times. Between Neil and Katie, I hope we come to a set of understandings about this moment in American public life and what we might hope for and work towards next. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan. I have two guests today. First, Katie Couric, who I'm sure you know from her many years on the Today Show, followed by a guy named Neil Katyal, who has argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court while also somehow living a life as a Georgetown constitutional law professor. These are conversations to share with people who were obsessed with the Today Show way back when Katie was at the anchor desk, or people who are studying the law, the first generation Americans in your life, and really anyone who wants to be reminded that even with its flaws, this is still an all right country. These conversations were filmed with the support of PBS from my TV show there called Tell Me More. You can watch any episode of Tell Me More anytime you like on pbs.org/Kelly. 1984. Ronald Reagan, Purple Rain, The Mac, and a young Katie Couric finagles her way into an ABC affiliate, pulling up her chair to the table for the first time. Her experience from the Today Show to the country's first solo female news anchor, and then online with Yahoo, and now with her newsletter, Instagram Lives, and podcast, makes her an invaluable source of insight at this moment when the way we understand what's happening across the street and around the world just keeps changing. Here's my conversation with cultural icon, insatiable journalist, and gardening enthusiast, Katie Couric. 38 years ago, you're like a little cub reporter in Miami. What did you think you were doing? What journey did you think you were setting out on?
I wanted to be a network correspondent by the time I was 30. That was my goal when I was in local news. I wasn't a very good reporter. I was dreadful live. And I thought I was just kind of getting experience under my belt so I would be able to grow and learn from that and ultimately cover Capitol Hill or the White House.
And was your ambition around changing the world? Was there a journalist that you were like, I want to be like that person? I mean, where did this come from?
I think primarily from my father, who was a print journalist. He covered politics for the Atlanta Constitution.
Yeah.
He later worked for United Press in Tallahassee in Washington, D.C. I think my dad gave me this love of writing, this love of being curious. I excelled at writing. That was one thing I really loved and I was good at. And I was a real procrastinator, so I knew I wrote well under pressure. My dad used to make fun of me doing my homework in front of the front door before the bus came because I had waited till the last minute. And so I think it was one of those things, Kelly, where my skill set and my interests and my passions really aligned with a particular profession. Yeah. And I feel so grateful for that because I've never felt like I've worked a day in my life.
38 years ago, it was like the big three. You know, there were these three networks, there were three places to get your news. Now I think there's 3,000 sources and they're all in your pocket at any time, right?
Yeah.
Did you feel serious about signing on to this set of journalistic standards?
Well, it was a very different time when I got into the business in 1979. I'm proud of my age, actually. Yeah. That's when I graduated from college. And it was such a dramatically different landscape. Three network news divisions, really. CNN started in 1980, and I was one of the original founding members of Chicken Noodle News, as they used to call us. Yeah. You know, it was really before the internet.
Yeah.
And there's that very funny clip of me and Brian Gumbel discussing the internet
so
and what
great.
The app means. It was very, very different. You know, that has pros and cons. I've often been told when I lament about the good old days or wax poetically about how things used to be, that there were so many people who were not represented in the media landscape. People of color, women, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds. I mean, it was a very white male bastion. But there were gatekeepers. There weren't a million people kind of giving their point of view or reporting information. We had certain standards, you know. Things had to be reviewed by a producer or an editor. We had to double source things. I mean, there were very specific things we had to do. We would always strive for accuracy, obviously, understanding that news develops and things change. So you can't be 100% accurate. But I think everything changed with the invention of the iPhone. We started seeing the democratization of news, which was in many ways a positive thing. There have been a confluence of events and factors that have really dramatically changed the modern media landscape.
Yeah.
Some things for the better, and certainly many things for the worse. It is a bitterly polarized news landscape, not only in cable news, but also online.
For sure.
With algorithms feeding people what my friend says is affirmation, not information.
Yes.
And this whole idea of engagement through enragement and kind of how can we gin up a lot of outrage to get people to really not only kind of be engaged, but also continue to be fed, because that visceral feeling is so satisfying in a weird psychological way.
I know.
So news has changed so, so much. I'm so grateful I did it when I did it. I still continue to do it in a different way, in a very modern way. But it would be, I think, extremely dispiriting to work in network news now.
If we're to live in this environment and we're just lay people trying to figure out what happened today? What do we do?
I don't know. That's a great question. When so many people think that Donald Trump won the election and believe that January 6th was caused by the Democratic National Committee, Joe Biden, and Antifa, you know we've got a real problem. And we are living in a post-truth world. The big test, I think, in a post-Trump world is, well, straight down the middle news, with some analysis, is that something that people want to hear? I mean, they have to be intellectually rigorous to kind of also think for themselves and practice their critical thinking skills and assess a certain situation and not be spoon-fed what they're supposed to think or feel. And, you know, I hope that we haven't lost our appetite for those things.
Was there a story that you wish you could have a do-over on?
One that comes to mind is one I wrote about in my book, and that was an interview I did with John and Elizabeth Edwards. And for some reason, It was about the choice she made to continue on the campaign trail with her husband after she had been told she had metastatic breast cancer that had gone into her bones. And I came across as strangely sort of judgmental about the decision she had made, which is so bizarre given that I had lost my husband to cancer not long before that. I really regret it. And I wrote her a note apologizing. And she was incredibly understanding. But I think to the world watching it, it just felt tonally off.
Yeah. And what about stories you really nailed, stories you feel proud of?
One that I was really proud of was my interview with Sarah Palin in the 2008 campaign, because she was this new, exciting figure, but nobody had really interrogated her policy positions or her sort of accumulated knowledge or her ability to think critically and talk about the very pressing issues of the day. I was very non-judgmental during the interview. And as a result, I think people saw her as she really was. And that was not ready for prime time. She wasn't ready to be a heartbeat away from the presidency. Madeleine Albright said, whatever you do, just let her talk. And I did. And I think as a result, that conversation was extremely revelatory.
Right.
And helpful to voters.
Katie Kirk, are you ready for the Tommy Moore speed round?
I am ready.
Right on. First concert.
Pink Floyd.
Nice. Best live performance you've ever seen.
Oh, well, I'm a big Broadway nut.
Me too.
So I have to say the most moving, probably Les Mis.
What was your first job?
I was a counselor at a camp for blind kids in Washington, D.C.
Wow. Last book that blew you away.
I recently read In Love by Amy Bloom.
Oh, yeah.
I love The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander. Mm-hmm. She's a beautiful writer. So those two come to mind.
Yeah. What do you wish you had more time to do?
I would like to learn to play the violin.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
It's awesome.
But it sounds painful for my loved ones, so I think I'm not going to do that.
When was the last time you cried?
I rewatched Beaches for some reason.
That's just made to make you cry.
And I just cried. I think I needed kind of to unburden myself. I had a lot of toxins that I clearly needed to get rid of.
What's something big you've been wrong about?
That anatomy dictates identity.
If your high school did superlatives, what would you have been most likely to become?
That's very dangerous. Most likely to be the center of attention.
Do you have stories that come to mind when you think at your life at the Today Show or at CBS where you went toe-to-toe with someone and said, I don't want to do that story? And they said, Katie, it doesn't matter. Like, that people want this story. Like, cover it or get out of here.
I mean, I feel like I was with really pretty responsible people. I mean, I think when Jeff Zucker did the Today Show, I described him in my book as kind of a combination of Edward R. Murrow and P.T. Barnum. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a showman, but I think he also had a nose for a good news story. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was in local news, and I wrote about this as well, they wanted me to do a series about working couples, and it's called No Time for Sex. Uh-huh. And I said to my news director, I'm 27 and single. I have plenty of time for sex. Get I.J. Hudson, that old married guy over there, get him to do that series. Because I think they wanted me to do it because they thought it would be a little sexier if I did it. And I said, no, I'm not doing it.
Right. Interesting. If you think about the increased need for media literacy, if you could whisper into the Department of Education and say, this is what we have to teach in schools in K-12. What would you teach?
I think a lot of it is going on now, but I'd make it required. I think that I would call the class or the program Consider the Source. Mm-hmm. Because now, you know, it's not enough to say, oh, I read this. When I see things, I say, who wrote it? What source are they citing? And I Google that source and I realize, oh, this is garbage.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of time and effort to have media literacy today.
Right.
And you know, people are busy in the 24/7 news cycle. You could be spending every waking hour kind of investigating the veracity of everything you read.
Right. You know what else you read when you were a kid growing up?
What?
Now magazine.
Oh, the one that I wrote?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tell everybody about Now magazine.
Oh, well, you know, I think because my dad was a reporter and I loved to write and I was actually kind of a creative kid. Yeah. You know, I loved to draw and I did a whole magazine with articles in it. It's still in my sentimental box at home.
It's great.
Where I had articles and advertisements and poems and all sorts
Amazing.
Of things. Yeah, it was fun.
Now that you have your own Katie Couric Media, which is your own version of Now Magazine, how do you decide what you want to cover and how do you decide how to cover it?
It's things I'm curious about, things that I don't quite understand. And I always think, well, I'm pretty well read and I'm pretty well informed. If I'm having trouble truly understanding something, could I help people who follow me or who subscribe to our newsletter better understand? I'd love to do hard breaking news, but I also like to do some fun things too. I like to do recipes and I like fashion and I like, you know, psychology and all kinds of important topics and relationship advice. So we kind of really cover the gamut. And I've got an incredible team of people. And a lot of times we're collaborating with purpose driven brands or brands that have particular missions. Because as faith in institutions has declined, a lot of companies are kind of stepping in.
I know, it's interesting.
And saying, we want to take a stand. We want to take a stand because consumers care and our employees really care about more than just the bottom line, especially millennials and Gen Zs. So it's interesting. We're saying, well, what do you care about? Is it environmental sustainability? Is it gender equality? Is it racial justice? Is it health and wellness? Is it preventative medicine? You know, so we work with them and we do storytelling that is aligned with both of our values. So, and it's editorially independent, but it's brand supported.
Is there anything that you do much differently now than you did, say, 20, 30 years ago in terms of reporting?
I would say I'm more vocal about my opinion, I think. You know, it's funny because part of me thinks that that has been the death knell of the news business. Too much commentary and not enough reporting.
Yes.
But there are some issues that I feel so passionately about that I feel comfortable saying we've got to do something. I think people want to see a full person. I don't think it necessarily takes away from your authority, but, you know, it's also very different, like a morning show versus an evening newscast.
I'm thinking a little bit about local journalism and newspapers and when there were these sources that we considered infallible. And then wondering about what you added to the mix by being approachable and personal and letting us know things about you.
I think that it is even more of a parasocial relationship since I was like doing morning television.
Yeah.
And I always tried to keep some kind of dividing line between my life and the viewers while letting them into some parts of it. Obviously, when Jay got sick and for 9 months was going through colon cancer and then died, I'm not sure I would have been so open about my experiences, but I felt like I could really do something positive by informing people about colon cancer and colon cancer prevention. And that's why I did my colonoscopy. You know, I used it as a springboard to inform people and to hope and to save lives, which I actually did. That's a pretty cool thing to be able to say.
And a pretty cool thing to be able to do with that moment and all that heartache and grief is to sort of put it to some use for some greater good. One of the things I feel like that has to be handled delicately that you've had to deal with as a journalist for a long time now is mass shootings. Do you have thoughts or feelings after covering so many different shootings, so many different ways with so many different outlets, sadly, about how best to cover really sensitive things like that, that might have follow-on effects that we are should be very careful to avoid?
Well, there's a big debate on how mass shootings are covered. Should you talk about the shooter? Does that glamorize and glorify the shooter? Does that result in copycat shootings? So I've seen that really shift a lot, and a lot of focus is now on the victims and not the shooter. The other thing that has been a big conversation of late is, are we protecting the public too much? Should they know more about what a weapon of war, an AR-15, actually does to a human body? That it pretty much makes hamburger meat out of human flesh. And maybe they need to be shocked as they become more inured to these mass shootings. So I don't know the answer to that question. I just know we have to do something about this situation. We're the only country in the world that has this problem to this extent.
Yeah.
And I think assault weapons should be banned as they were from 1994 to 2004. Clearly, there are a lot of very disturbed and lost people who are turning to violence. Young men primarily between the ages of 18 and 20. The way I have done it is to really honor the victims, to make sure people understand the lives lost, to share personal stories about the victims, because I think too often people become statistics. And so when there is a tragedy, my team and I really try to put a human face mm-hmm. on the loss. And it just makes it so much more real to people.
I know, because I follow you and I see it after these shootings, one after the other, where you just put the picture of the victim and a little something about them in the caption.
I think it makes you understand that that could be me. That could
That's right.
be my child.
That's right.
That could be my sister. So that is the way that I honor the victims of gun violence. And I think it's appreciated by everyone, mm-hmm. the families of those people and the people who are reading about them.
We have a thing on Tell Me More. It's called Plus One, and it's a chance for each of our guests to shout out somebody who makes their lives a lot better in one way or another, informs their work, looks after their well-being. Who's your plus one?
There are so many people, honestly, that have had an impact on my life, that have changed me, that have made me chart a different course. You know, might be my husband, Jay, who made me become a lifelong cancer activist and somebody who has been determined to focus on prevention and awareness and funding cancer research. I think another person would be Mark Barden, who helped me continue on this path of making people aware of the issue of gun violence. I met Mark Barden and his wife, Jackie, on December 16, 2012, 2 days after Sandy Hook. You know, one of the hardest jobs as a reporter is to talk to people who've gone through something terrible. And I knocked on their door and they opened it and they let me into their home after the worst day of their lives, where their son Daniel had been murdered in elementary school. And I got to know them very well as a result of that. Before that, Craig Scott, who I had interviewed after Columbine, who'd lost his sister Rachel, and I still stay in touch. So I think this started me on a journey, Kelly, of really trying to understand and deal with the problem of gun violence in America. Mm-hmm. I couldn't understand after Sandy Hook why legislation didn't pass, even though I think it was 92% of Americans believe that there should be stricter gun laws in this country. Mark and Nicole Hockley, who also lost her son at Sandy Hook, started something called Sandy Hook Promise, which is in 23,000 schools. It helps kids and communities understand the warning signs of someone who might be the perpetrator of gun violence. They have handled their tragedy and this unspeakable loss with such grace and equanimity and compassion. It's been almost something sacred to witness. And the people I know who have suffered these terrible losses, they have changed my perspective so profoundly, and I think sent me on a mission to understand how we can create a safer country.
Yeah. So I wanted to thank you. In 2004,
yeah,
you sat down with me and my dad. We had just finished chemotherapy, the both of us, and we ended up on that couch with you for 19 minutes, which I think is a Today Show record. And it's a little bit surreal to be on the other side
Isn't
of the equation
funny?
Today. But I really thank you so much.
I hope I was as good a guest today as you were all those years ago.
If I could have you stay longer, I would. Here are my takeaways from my conversation with Katie Couric. Number one, procrastinators can win in the end. Katie Couric used to do her homework at the bus stop. Number two, it's quite possible we are now in the age of affirmation over information and engagement through enragement. Number three, we will have to decide, do we want to practice critical thinking or have we lost our appetite for that kind of work and just want to be told what to think? Number four, anatomy does not dictate identity. Number five, consider the source. Who wrote it? What sources are they citing? And what do they have to gain? Number six, consumers and employees can drive change from within corporate America. Number seven, even if you don't want to have a colonoscopy on national television, you might well be able to put your heartache to use. And number eight, here's to the Sandy Hook promise. Coming up next, lawyer, academic, and American, Neil Katyal. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are just right for the role you've got. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. LinkedIn gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else, all the while making the process easy and intuitive. I mean, when you have that many quality candidates, hiring gets a lot easier. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. So maybe you're 24 hours from finding your perfect next hire. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Kelly. That's linkedin.com/Kelly to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan. As I'm sure you can tell, I enjoyed every minute of my conversation with Katie. If you'd like to watch the episode of Tell Me More featuring our conversation, you can check it out online anytime at pbs.org/Kelly. Later that same day, at the Whitney Museum in New York City, I sat down with attorney, academic, and American Neil Katyal.
People who know it back to front will tell you the Constitution is, in some ways, miraculous. 39 men, one as young as 26, another as old as 81, debated for 3 months every word in the document that still guides our government today. They distributed power between two kinds of lawmakers, federal and state judges, and one president. They built in checks and balances, knowing some of us will grasp for power by any means. And ironically, the document itself assured rights to one group over all others, and though amended, is still sometimes used to hoard power. Georgetown constitutional law professor Neil Katyal has argued in front of the Supreme Court 47 times. Cases involving Nestle and NASA, the Affordable Care Act, Donald Trump, and the driver of Osama bin Laden. He is also the former Solicitor General and the very proud son of Indian immigrants. When you look at the Constitution, what parts astonish you and what parts will we be arguing until the end of time?
First of all, the Constitution's only about 3,000 words. And so you think about like op-ed pieces we've written are like 3,000 words. Think about what kind of genius it takes to write that blueprint for a new nation. And Chief Justice John Marshall, in the greatest legal opinion ever in McCulloch versus Maryland, in my judgment, he said, you know, the Constitution just marks the great outlines. It's a document intended to endure for ages to come. The only way that works is by having a document that's flexible. To me, the great thing about the Constitution is its suppleness, and so it can adapt to the various crises of human affairs, as the Chief Justice put it in McCulloch. What are we going to fight about? I mean, you know, obviously, privacy and equality and religion are central to the kind of modern debates at the Supreme Court. I am concerned about where the Supreme Court is going on these issues. You know, I have enormous respect for each of the nine individually. I've argued, obviously, before them many times. But I think collectively, this group of nine is more conservative than any Supreme Court in our lifetimes.
I wondered if, because we are prone to our nature and that our nature wants to reach consensus and conclusion and leave uncertainty behind as fast as possible, if when you enter the courtroom, you're pretty much talking to a room full of people who have already made their mind up.
It's feeling like that a bit more than in past courts. Now, in the past, it was justices like Kennedy, O'Connor, Souter, Blackmun, people who, even if they were appointed by Republican presidents, often voted so-called liberal on the liberal way. They had an open mind. I mean, to me, Justice Kennedy was kind of the ideal justice because every time I'd go before the court, I could see he hadn't made up his mind. And he's listening and he's struggling. And sometimes almost his face had agony in it because he just couldn't figure out what to do. He'd hear an argument by my great opponent. He'd be like, that sounds good. Then he'd hear my argument. He's like, that sounds good. That's kind of what you want in a judge. And we're losing, unfortunately, a bit of that. I just want nine open-minded, smart individuals. That, to me, is what the Supreme Court is at its best.
How many of the nine right now are open-minded, smart individuals?
Well, it's going to depend on the case. All of them are smart. I mean, that, you know, there are, I think, some, you know, attacks on some of the justices for being dumb or this or that. That I don't buy at all. The open-mindedness is going to vary case by case, but it's less and less. I look at the abortion decision that happened earlier this year, and that is a heartbreaking decision. More than heartbreaking, it is a decision that sets women back by decades, centuries, perhaps. I kind of can't fathom five justices on the Supreme Court doing such a thing. And in part because, to me, one of the things I love about the Supreme Court is its respect for precedent, what the rule is called stare decisis. And the idea behind it is a kind of Edmund Burke idea that there's a wisdom in past generations and how other justices, how other jurists have done things traditionally. And that's what gives our legal system stability. And so Roe versus Wade was a decision in 1973. It was a 7-2 decision at a time when seven of the justices on the Supreme Court appointed by Republican presidents. But still, they reached that decision. Justice Blackmun wrote the decision, nominated by a Republican president. And then the Republican Party made it a campaign pledge to try and overturn Roe versus Wade. And they thought Roe was going to be overturned. And lo and behold, those justices actually came together in 1992 in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey and said, look, Roe might be right. It might be wrong. We understand there are all sorts of criticisms about it, but it is woven into the fabric of the land. It's critical to women's equality. And if we overturn it now, it's going to undermine the court's legitimacy. It'll make it look like we're not doing law. We're just doing politics. Those were Republican justices in 1992.
And I think this is one of the most unsettling facets of this overturning. If precedent isn't the way, then what is?
And, or put differently, if they can overturn Roe versus Wade, they can overturn anything.
Right.
Because Roe is actually the super precedent. It's the hardest decision to overturn because of what those justices said in 1992, that it's so woven into the fabric of the land. I mean, it's one of the few decisions that Americans know by name.
I know, but they did. But they overturned it.
And if they can do that, I'm worried about marriage equality, something I spent 4 years working on. I'm worried about the right to contraception, the right to privacy. All sorts of things that we have taken for granted over the last years are now squarely in the target of some justices on the Supreme Court.
What will we make decisions based on, if not precedent?
I'm hopeful that precedent does make a return to command a majority of the Supreme Court. And in particular, I'm looking at Justice Kagan. And what she has been saying, not just in the last year, but for the last 10 years, is how important legal precedent is to the stability of the law. And her voice, I think, will have an outsized influence over time. So that's my hope.
You know how you can quote the Bible to support a whole bunch of different positions? Is that also true of the Constitution, that there's something there for anybody who wants to make any argument?
No. I think the Constitution does have a series of meanings, and I think also history does. I'm worried about what this Supreme Court has done, for example, on gun control. So what they've done is they've said, well, we've gone back and looked at the history of the right to bear arms, and it means that everyone in America has a right to carry a concealed firearm. I'm sorry, that is not in the history and not in the text of the Constitution. So words have meaning, history has meaning. These folks have distorted that history. It's got to have some more serious purpose and integrity behind it. And that's, to me, what law is. Law is not politics. You're going to reach different results if you're a lawyer than you are from reaching what you would do as a politician.
It does bring up the need for a greater understanding and appreciation and respect for history.
There's a dearth of information about our history, which is so beautiful and so tragic in all sorts of ways. It's not being taught. My next big project is to teach kids through a TV series, The Constitution and Our History.
When you think about the standard of a document being evergreen, do you ever think, well, maybe we should bake in that at 100 million people or 200 million people or 300 million people or some number of years that we should automatically reconsider this document? It's such a high bar.
It is a high bar. And Jefferson's proposal at the founding was to do that, like every generation have a new constitution. Phew. I think stability is really important in any governmental system. Our constitution's endured because it's got that suppleness built into it. I certainly wouldn't want to be guided by the dead hand of 1787, mm-hmm. but I think we're not. I mean, you know, everything from women or minorities being able to vote and be equal participants in society, that's all a result of the Constitution being flexible and allowing an amendment process and the like. I think the alternative to me scares me. If we had a constitutional convention right now, mm-hmm. I don't know if the First Amendment survives.
Sometimes you see on cable news, in the breaking news, because everything's breaking news, in the Chiron that there's going to be a constitutional crisis. Has there ever been a moment in your life as an attorney where you thought this really might come to pass?
There were a couple of days during the election in 2020 where Trump was doing such outrageous things, and of course, January 6th itself and the attack on the Capitol, where I felt our nation's fundamental values were under attack, that we had put someone in power as president who cared more about himself than constitutional governance. I felt pretty confident the system would hold, in part because Donald Trump was such a buffoon at doing what he was doing. I worry that we're losing because of tribalism in our current democracy and the idea that you can only agree with your friends and you have to disagree with everyone else and you have to go to war against them and attack their motivations. I think we're losing a lot of what it means to be a resilient democracy. The day that Justice Breyer retired, I typed out an op-ed about his character of always respecting the other side to go and say, hey, I'm going to listen to you. Maybe I'll disagree ultimately, but I want to hear you out. And I think if citizens did a little more of that, we'd be a much healthier democracy.
You saw Guantanamo before you started arguing cases. And then it turned out that your very first case in front of the Supreme Court was about Guantanamo. Tell us about that case.
After the nation was horrifically attacked on September 11th, I was trying to figure out what to do. And I started working with first responders. I wasn't particularly good at it, but I tried. And then on November 13th, 2001, 2 months later, President Bush announced these military trials at Guantanamo for suspected terrorists. And I thought to myself, that is totally unconstitutional. And so I did what a law professor does. I wrote a law review article about it. I testified on the Hill. Nobody paid any attention to any of that. And so ultimately, I decided, look, I really care about this. The idea of having a legal black hole at Guantanamo is anathema to me as a United States, you know, citizen, lawyer, et cetera. And so I created a test case. I had a friend at the Pentagon who I was able to use to get a letter to a Guantanamo detainee to say, I'd like to represent you. And that detainee who got that letter ultimately turned out to be Osama bin Laden's driver. So I went to Guantanamo. They made it really hard for me. I take a bus to a boat to a van that takes me ultimately to meet my client, Mr. Salim Hamdan. And he is in leg irons in a solitary cell, which he'd been in for 10 months. He hadn't seen another human face. Guards wearing masks so he couldn't see their face. And he looks at me and he says, I need to talk to you through the translator. And I think he's going to yell at me. And he says, why are you doing this? Why are you representing me? And I remember being so taken aback. So I say, look, my parents came here from another country and they didn't come because of the quality of its sports teams or the quality of its soil. They came for one simple idea. They could land on its shores. Their children would be treated fairly. They'd be treated fairly. That not perfectly, but better than any other country on earth. And I said to him, you know, this is the first time in my life that promise that my parents felt for why they came is being betrayed. Because this is the first time ever in our history, through every war, in which we've set up a different system of justice for non-U.S. citizens. If you're a U.S. citizen and you're accused of the worst crime, detonation of a weapon of mass destruction, you still get the Cadillac system of justice, the American civil trial system. But if you're a non-citizen or one of the 12 million green card holders like my parents or 7 billion people around the planet, you can be accused of a far less crime, but you get the beat up Chevy version of justice at Guantanamo. And I said, we've just never done that. The Constitution in the 14th Amendment says guarantees equal protection of the law to all persons, all persons. It doesn't use the word citizens. That's why I did that case, because it was a fundamental betrayal of our promise of equality.
And you won.
Everyone thought we'd lose that case. And when we won it in the Supreme Court, it definitely changed my life.
Your father came to this country with $8. What was his first job?
His first job, he was trained as a chemical engineer, and his first job was actually at a slaughterhouse, which is not a great job for a Hindu. I was a chemist at a pharmaceutical plant, and he just worked his way up. He worked super hard. It's amazing to me, like someone leaving all their friends and family behind with very little because of a dream that'll be better for their kids. I just think that's the most remarkable.
I know. Yeah. I mean, it's the ultimate romantic American story, you know. And your mom, she was a pediatrician?
My mom's a pediatrician. She also came here separately from my dad with very little, but she did have a medical degree and a internship at Children's Hospital Boston.
Oh, wow.
And so, so then they kept on going back to India to interview candidates for marriage. It was kind of an arranged marriage, but not really. Both of them were really picky and their parents were getting annoyed, but they met each other and decided in 5 minutes to get married.
And it worked.
It worked beautifully.
And your mom, you said your mom is a pediatrician, like she's still practicing?
My mom is a pediatrician. She's 87 years old or so. We don't know because the village in which she was born didn't keep records, but she still practices full time. She tried to retire last year and got bored, so she went back to work.
Unbelievable. What are their names?
Pratibha and Surinder.
And you said that you think immigrants love this country more.
I think if you've known another world and another government and you've seen, for example, like my parents, the corruption there or the lack of equality, and then you see this country for all its flaws, and there are so many, we are a more perfect union. I mean, one of my long-term dreams is to build a museum devoted to immigration and refugees, because I think that's the path by which so many people have come to this country. And it's the story of America. And it's not actually being told.
Tell me about that day Overfell came down.
So the marriage equality cases were really interesting. There was a whole cast of characters and people who did far more than I did and who'd been committed for decades to this moment. And there was a big debate in the community. Are we going too fast? Is the court going to be ready to recognize the right to marriage equality? Ultimately, I sided with the people who said, we don't have time to wait. There are people who may pass away who want to get married, people who want to have children and families and whatever. How can we just sit on our hands and wait for a better time? And I remember we would trudge up to the Supreme Court at 10 a.m. every day, waiting for decisions to come down. We knew it would be the last day of the term, like that's normally how it is, which is around June 30th. But we were all there, I think it was around June 27th. And we walk into the courtroom, and on one side of the outside plaza, about 100 people saying gay marriage is horrible, and another 100 saying gay marriage is awesome. We walk into the courtroom, and the Chief Justice says, Justice Kennedy is announcing the opinion in Obergefell. And so that felt good to us because Justice Kennedy was very sympathetic in general to LGBT rights. But he asked a lot of hard questions at the oral argument. So we weren't totally sure. And then Justice Kennedy, for about 8 minutes, is reading his opinion. And it's all about how the tradition of marriage is between one man and one woman. So we think that we've miscalculated, that basically we've lost this case. Justice Kennedy is saying the tradition of marriage between one man and one woman. He pauses and says, but that tradition does not stop here. And then he talks about the American tradition of equality. And it still brings tears to my eyes. I was thinking about my sister who is gay. I was thinking about so many of my friends and what they've gone through. And you hear this 5-4 decision that says that there is now a right for people to marry whomever they want to marry. And we walked out of the courtroom, and there were about 7,000 people on the Supreme Court Plaza, arms linked, singing America the Beautiful, the gay pride flags swinging in the wind along with the American flag. It was one of the most beautiful sights of my life. I think about that as what law is ultimately. That is the soul of law. It's the soul of this country at its best, that we are a more perfect union. We're making progress. The arc of justice bends that way, but it's because all those people bent it.
I have heard it said that we cannot systematically protect democracy from bad actors, that work really rests with the people, that in America, the people are king. How do you think we're doing as a citizenry?
popular sovereignty is the essence of our Constitution. Obviously, the people are king. I'm worried now that we are becoming more tribal. I'm worried that we're becoming more extreme and not able to listen to folks on the other side. We need to cultivate a little bit more respect for listening to one another. I think that is being diminished, and our political leaders are part of that problem because they just demonize the other side. Right. At some point, we need to figure out a way to stop this cycle. It's going to require people like you who talk about these things, who bring it to viewers' attention, that say, enough of this. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out how to get back to a democracy.
And what do you think it takes to be a great citizenry? Like, there's got to be some role for K-12 education in all this. And then there's also Samantha Power, who we interviewed, who said we should all go to a naturalization ceremony once a mm-hmm. week because it reminds us how desperately people want to be here.
I love the Samantha Power idea of a naturalization ceremony. Every time a judge invites me to perform one, I do, and I bring my kids because it's so powerful, a reminder of how great this country is and how many people want to be here. So that, or jury service, or even public schooling, or civics education, all that's really, really important. But I guess I have a more kind of fundamental, maybe a hokey answer, but it's really love. I mean, and if you think about every religious tradition, it's all about trying to see the inner light in someone else who thinks differently than you. I feel like we've lost that as a society. And it isn't something actually that government can ultimately teach. However one wants to come out on these policy issues, there should be a fundamental respect for people who are different. And that's what I think religion is at its best. I think that's what this country is at its best.
Ready for the speed round?
Bring it on.
First concert.
Sean Cassidy.
Oh, best live performance you've ever seen.
The National in Ann Arbor 4 years ago. I'd seen him about 30 times, but this is the first time I got to meet them, and they put me on the side stage.
Oh, my God. If your high school did superlatives, what would you have been most likely to become?
A boring doctor.
What's your go-to mantra for hard times?
Bad can be good.
That's great. Is there anyone you would like to apologize to?
I'd like to apologize to my sister. When my dad fell ill with brain cancer, it really fell on her to take care of him more than me, and that's always haunted me.
When was the last time you cried?
When I was special prosecutor in the George Floyd case, and when we got the verdict, I cried, and my kids thought we had lost because all they saw was my tears, but we won.
What's something big you've been wrong about?
I thought that the country's laws would hold us together, but it's really the norms and personalities, and as we've seen, they can come apart.
If you could pass one law or overturn one Supreme Court case?
Easy. Dobbs, the recent abortion decision.
If your mother wrote a book about you, what would it be called?
My Amazing Son.
We have something at Tell Me More called Plus One, where we want to give you a chance to shout out somebody who's instrumental to your thinking or your well-being. Who's your Plus One?
His name is Guido Calabresi. He is the first judge for whom I clerked. He was my dean at Yale Law School and then a very prominent judge on the Court of Appeals.
And what does he help you do better?
Everything. First of all, I learned the idea that good ideas come from anywhere. Second, his love of other people. This is a guy who every time a former student calls, no matter how busy he is, he'll take the call, help the person. And so that idea of trying to treasure every human being comes a lot from him. And then third and last, he had an identity of being an immigrant. And I'd never had a role model before who had that as such a big part of who they were. Mm-hmm. And he loves this country to no end.
Yeah.
And he cares so much about the freedoms and rights that we have. In my ideal Supreme Court, there's 9 Guido Calabreses.
That's great. Here's to Guido. Worst case, best case, most likely case, America in 2030. What does it look like?
Better. I'm an optimist. I was in a tiny town in Colorado on July 4th. Hundreds of women protesting the decision, signs saying Ruth sent us and things like that. You know, that to me is what the country is all about. I don't think we lose that fighting spirit. I think that America can totally turn the corner on this toxicity
and the poison can work itself out of the system.
Thanks a lot for saying yes. It's really a joy to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Here are my takeaways from talking to Neil Katyal, a conversation you can see anytime on pbs.org/Kelly. All right, here we go. Number one, the best thing about the Constitution is its suppleness. Number two, as shown by Justice Kennedy, there is real agony in making up your mind case by case rather than deferring to your biases. Number three, precedent is essential. Number four, law is not politics. Words have meaning. History has meaning. Number five, if you ever get invited to a naturalization ceremony, go. Number six, any thoughts I had of retiring went out the window as soon as I learned that Neil Katyal's 87-year-old mother is still a practicing pediatrician. Number seven, when you need to believe again, remember Obergefell. Number eight, good ideas can come from anywhere. Number nine, norms are more powerful than laws. And number 10, the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice because we bend it. I want to thank PBS. I want to thank Megan Mackay and Alan Thorpe, Sue and Dave Tennell, who are super generous, great people who support this show and our desire to surface positive stories of people doing good in America right now. I want to thank the team at Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That's technical producer Dean Kateri, executive producer Tammy Stedman, and Garrett Peters, who edits and mixes the interviews for PBS. I want to thank my friends Steve Goldblum and Melissa Williams at Second Peninsula and the whole team there that helped us capture these conversations. Join us on Friday for a new episode of For the Good of the Order, and on Sunday for a new episode of Thanks for Being Here. Please share this episode with family and friends, and if you have a spare moment, please rate us on your favorite podcast app. In the meantime, I'll see you on Instagram at Kelly Corrigan.